Yes, we are going. Okay. I'm Vince McGowan. Here, today's date is December 16th, 2006, and we're sitting in the den of my residence in Eagan, Minnesota, and going to be speaking with my brother, Sean. So, Sean, could you tell us when and where you were born? And
Sure.
Oh, you get to introduce yourself. Okay.
Oh, and I got to take this? Or no?
I can just...
Yeah. Sean T. McGowan. Terrence. And misspelled. I can never get the spelling right. But we were going to start
about where you were born, where you grew up, and what it was like living there.
Appleton, Minnesota. Appletown, Minnesota, we'd say from time to time. I lived there till we were in the seventh grade, actually between seventh and eighth grade in 1965. When we moved to the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul.
And what are your memories of growing up in a small town, and what did you like about it? What?
Generally fond. Yeah, I enjoyed the easy go lucky nature of the town, and where everybody knew everybody else, and it was easy to make friends, and could be a big cat in school. Started some athletics then in seventh grade. I guess I was disappointed we moved away right when some of that was beginning to take off.
So, did you get in trouble while you were growing up in Appleton?
There might have been one occasion that I think you and I participated in together. Something related to stealing cigarettes from the local grocery stores and trying to pilfer them for profit. To some of your friends, I knew who none of these smokers were.
So that's probably one of your worst memories. But what's one of your best memories of Appleton?
Oh gosh, there were many. I just think maybe the friends in school beginning to play basketball and baseball. I like that. Probably the sports memories as a child, you know, very youthful. What did that make me, 10 or 12 years old? Those are fond memories.
And then later the family moved to the Twin Cities, you said, and talk about your experience growing up and going to high school in the Twin Cities.
Well, we spent a year at the Holy Childhood School, my eighth grade. And then I probably followed a lot of my classmate pals there to Cretan High School. And things worked out well there. I acclimated myself fairly well. It worked, you know, I'm glad I was, at that point, it turned out I was glad I was younger than if I had been in high school. It might have been more difficult to have a successful high school, or that transition at age 14, 15, probably more difficult. So... Again, enjoyed the sports there in Cretan, basketball, and track.
Talk about some of your friends during high school. I know you just spent some time with some of them.
Yeah, it was, a handful out of Holy Childhood School. As I indicated, I probably followed them to Cretan because we were such good pals, didn't know that much about the high school. But, hey, if you guys are going, I'm going too. And you met them again last night. From there, you know, I had the opportunity to meet a lot of guys that became friends from the other grade school parishes in town, St. Mark's, St. Luke's. So kind of didn't get buried in any one group of kids. I was on the band and got to know some kids that way, and basketball again, and then just like to mingle generally. It was a successful high school, both socialization, I think, and academics.
I remember that being a military school. What did you like about that, or did you?
I didn't really like that too much. Initially, you know, this is 67, 68, and I remember as a sophomore getting brochures from West Point, as in I might seek an appointment to go to West Point. But as the Vietnam War kind of turned south, I became kind of anti-war, impressionable, you know, clean Gene McCarthy, let's go do it. So all in all, then I kind of refused military appointments in school and took some pride in graduating as a buck private, although the records probably show I was a corporal. But I tried to reject all, any and all promotions. One particularly painful moment, I guess, I was in the band. As part of the being in the band was to avoid some of the military training. There were sort of an exemption, but we still had to play military a little bit in our marching and so forth. And I remember standing out there one cold morning, and I snuck my hands in my pocket, and the band leader took offense with that and kind of, I would say, snuck up on me from the right-hand side and clubbed me with this huge ball on the end of his marionette or whatever the hell it was. And I took great pains to avoid jumping down his throat and strangling him, because there were, in my view, no need to inflict such serious physical pain on my hand.
Was it true that you went to the inaugural with the band then?
We were selected to represent the state of Minnesota in the January 69 inauguration of the distinguished President Richard Milhouse Nixon.
I sent some sarcasm.
Yeah, serious sarcasm. It was sort of a mixed blessing. You know, we all wanted a trip to D.C., but the word politically was that we had stronger Republican boosters than Democrats. So if Humphrey had won, we were not going. If Nixon won, we were. So it's a good trip. It was a fun experience, but we got stuck with the wrong guy.
And then after high school, you went away to school.
Yeah, that was maybe, in retrospect, sort of a adolescent spring from the womb and get away from Minnesota, maybe even a little get away from the McGowans a little bit. That sounds resentful, and it isn't meant to be, and it really, it certainly is not how I feel today. But recognizing fairly or trying to be honest about that, it was clearly an attempt to, you know, I'm out of here. This is my chance. So I ended up at the University of Arizona in Tucson in fall of 1970. Sight unseen, I was going to go.
And you were happy with that choice? Tell us about your college experience then in Arizona.
Turned out wonderfully. Still wet behind the ears, but saw this whole new world, desert Southwest, and beautiful weather throughout the winter, and it's like, wow, this is great. So I hung in there academically, financially. It was a struggle to get through. As I recall, my parents were able to contribute about $1,000 a year, and beyond that, it was up to me. So I worked in the dorm to pay the board. I caddied at one of the local country clubs. Our dad's cousin, Pat Bailey, got me on at the Las Vegas Country Club to run the weekends. I could caddy and make 20, 30 bucks, and it was enough for my beans and tortillas for the week. So, yeah, I enjoyed it. I still have close friends from college that I met there in the dormitory. They'll be friends forever, too. I'm kind of reconnecting a little bit with the high school guys like last night. That was really wonderful. But I have done the same with some college pals that we keep in touch with on a regular basis.
And after undergraduate, you continued on at Arizona?
Yeah, well, I took a year off trying to decide whether to be a socialist or a communist, a capitalist. Get my political spectrum here in line. But this was 1974, and I blew off a year and went to Israel and lived on the kibbutz near Haifa.
And tell us, how did that happen? How did that come about?
Well, it was truly investigating the socialist lifestyle that the kibbutzim have. There's different strains. some are more radical than others in terms of private property rights and how the community would be organized. So it was through an immigration service in New York that was happy to place people who would work and study if you wanted to. There are different programs, a summer program, a longer-term program. So I just set it up, made a trip to New York just to, look them in the eye and make sure they were legit, and because they helped arrange the placement at a kibbutz. But it seemed genuine. All I had to do is pay my way over there, show up. And
so what did you do while you were there? How long were you there? And what did you do?
I was there 8 months, from September to April of the following year, 75. I worked, I guess they call it the refet, the hatchery and the chicken coops. It was a full-fledged, high-powered economic engine that had poultry and cotton, citrus orchards, cattle for dairy. But I ended up working in the hatchery, by and large. Dirty work, help cleaning out. We'd have to get under these chicken stalls that were 2 or 3 feet above the ground, so the chicken could crap, and then you'd blow it out with these hoses. And if you didn't blow it out with the hoses, you got down in there with the brooms and kept it sanitary. And it was hard work. So we worked half a day and then studied Hebrew language the other half a day.
And you had an interest in Judaism as well. It was part of this also?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. You smoked me out on that one.
Do you want to talk about that?
A little bit's fine. I guess what happened after the summer of 72, I took a job selling books about the Bible and ended up being placed in the Deep South. It was a summer job for me, and week of training in Nashville, but it was this conservative religious bent about, getting these books in the households. Well, did all right. I made $1,500 net for the summer, but in the course of that, met a lot of dogmatic right-wing Christian Baptists who really turned me off. And I guess I started to read and investigate alternative religions. Alternative, other mainstream religions. And I was drawn to Judaism because, if Jesus wasn't God, then I guess he was a good Jew. And maybe that's what I'd be looking at. So from about fall of 72, when I got back from this Georgia sales stint, I spent a year or so in study and studied with a rabbi there on campus. And by spring of 74, just as I was graduating college, I did a conversion to conservative Judaism. And, looking back on it, I didn't have to convert and become Jewish to go enjoy Israel and investigate what Israel is all about. And so maybe in retrospect, I was rash and jumped into it for the wrong reasons. Not wrong reasons, but today they look somewhat insufficient in that converting to new religion is maybe like adding a body part, a new limb. Well, sometimes it sticks, sometimes it doesn't.
So you never really practiced the religion then?
Not seriously. Thereafter, I did with friends. They'd take me to synagogue and hung in there with it for a period of years. But not, as time went on, it became more apparent that I didn't have the cultural, family, or ethnic support to really make it a deep part of me. I still have some affinity for the Jewish faith, but I didn't have to do that to get where I am today, probably.
And so after your experience in the kibbutz, you came back, or you went back to Arizona, and then where did you go from there?
I went to law school at the University of Arizona. Retook the LSAT when I exam in Tel Aviv and mailed it in, reapplied. Almost ended up at William Mitchell, but I was glad to get the Arizona approval too, because that's really where I wanted to be. So I went back fall 75, 3 years of law school, graduate May of 78. a job in Nevada. Tucson was a little tight job market for lawyers. So I moved to Nevada in the fall of 78.
Working for the Attorney General, as I
understand? No, 1 year clerkship, Judge Stan Smart on Fallon, Nevada. Marty visited out there. Then I ended up with the Attorney General a year later, fall of 79. Passed the Arizona, or the Nevada bar dues, a bar. Quickly, a guy can run through that if, you know, career history, you want that real quickly?
Sure.
So, Attorney General for 3 years. During the 3 years, I transferred from Carson City to Las Vegas. Sometime in 84, the Attorney General thing had kind of played itself out, and I had an opportunity to go work for Del Webb Corporation in Phoenix. So that was something I viewed as a positive element. I could, you know, work for this bi-state company with offices in both and maintain those relationships in both states. And it worked reasonably well, but by fall of 88, Del Webb was kind of getting out of the real estate business and the casino business. So I pretty much needed to go find something better or soon before they show me the door. There was kind of a numbers crunch in the law department. So I returned to Nevada. I got a nice offer with a private law firm. And then a second law firm in 93. So I was, you know, if you count the Del Webb years in the private law practice, I probably was 16 years in private law practice. And then in December of 99, I got an opportunity to become a city attorney for City of North Las Vegas. And it was the right time for me because of family considerations. I was finalizing a divorce at the time, and I wanted to spend more time with my kids.
So I wanted to come back to that. Tell us about Tamara Bybee and your relationships. And
I met Tamara through work in softball, you know, extracurricular. Some of the people at work, she was in the Gaming Control Board auditor, and I was a deputy attorney general, and we had mutual business interaction somewhat. That was 81, and when I went to Phoenix, we commuted one of us every weekend for a year, year and a half, in 84, 85, and then we got married in the fall of 85. I was still at Del Webb. And then she moved to Phoenix, you know, at some consternation to her own career and all that, but she did move to Phoenix, fall of 85, and from there, yeah, up and down marriage. She had what I viewed as intrusive parents in our relationship, and it was kind of like death by a thousand cuts, because I felt myself feeling insignificant in my own household. So I developed anger and bitterness over that, and I thought I tried to fix it several times throughout. And then after a while, I was down the track emotionally before she realized it was too late.
But you have two children. Talk about your children.
Oh, wonderful. Very joyous moments.
Okay. Do you remember when each of them were born, and how did you feel at that time?
Absolutely. Absolutely. CJ was February of 90. I was already 37 years old. Just wonderful. Oh, wow, I've got a son. This is fantastic. Then, you know, I'd have to admit, in Courtney's case, I had a slight little 30 seconds of disappointment that it was a girl. But, you know, over the time that I look at it now, it couldn't have been a better blessing just to learn more about the opposite sex, seeing it from moment of birth and throughout. Because the women are truly different. So, yeah, I think she's a love baby. Although I do recall when she was born, cold, windy night in January of 94, it's like, oh my gosh, I'm getting buried deeper in this marriage that I don't think is going to work. But we wanted to have Colin have a sibling. I think we each agreed upon that, notwithstanding the difficulties we were having. That he deserved a sibling, and we were going to try. It was up and down, a little bit where I thought Tamara realized we had some serious issues and we got to be very careful. It reverted to more of the same afterwards, after Courtney was born. Her parents basically moved in and they came and went without any accommodation or recognition that I was a part of the household, as I felt. I'm sure they didn't intend to make me feel that way, but that's how I felt. So then, by the time 96, 97, Courtney's 3 and 4, and I'm thinking the marriage is going down the tanks. Eventually, yeah, I laid it on her and said, we're done. Labor Day weekend in 97, I was like, we're done. And I never went back until perhaps recently we're friends again.
Which might have something to do with your illness. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, I wonder if this is some voice from on high that you need to forgive people. And whatever time you have and whatever friends and loving relationships you can have, they're blessings and we should accept them. I would like to think I could have done it differently. I mean, that I would be a bigger person. I mean, I'm not too harsh and critical that I did wrong, but I'd like to believe now that I could have done it better. And maybe we didn't have to get divorced if I had a different attitude toward relationships or how to solve problems. Well, I guess we didn't have the skills to do it then, whereas now I think maybe we would. We've had many nice chats about how it's nice to be friends again, and I forgive her and her family, and she forgives me. It's no hard feelings. It's I think there's love there again.
But a year ago, it was revealed to you faced a pretty tough challenge in life.
Yeah, I've got a diagnosis of mantle cell lymphoma. A year ago today, actually, was the call from the oncologist. So I've been kind of struggling with that all year.
What can you describe your feelings when the doctor gave you the diagnosis?
Yeah, shock and bewilderment. I wanted to get information and understand it because he was recommending an immediate jump into chemotherapy, and I didn't know what chemotherapy was, but he wanted to start, boom, Tuesday. You know, I'm getting the news on a Friday afternoon phone call, and he wants me to be in there Tuesday morning for chemotherapy. So it was difficult to deal with that. I was resistant to that approach from what I was able to read that first weekend, that chemotherapy doesn't work for mantle cell lymphoma. You've got to get the newer, better biological drugs that will latch onto the cells and kill just the cells you need to kill. But traditional medicine isn't there yet. They still make you fail twice the traditional chemo, the traditional Western medicine, before you get a shot at the new stuff. So we've done that. Still got a bullet left in the chamber. We're still working on it. Some radiation first, and then this ONTAC drug that is indicative of some success in other cancers, not in mine yet very much, but it's worth a try.
Can you... So what was you actually went ahead with the chemo? What was that like? I mean,
well, you know, you get hooked up and they start pumping poison in you. Pretty toxic stuff. I don't understand fully the biology and the chemistry of the drugs, but they're pretty toxic. Game plan was two different regimens, three times each, and each one had a slightly different variation, but it was pretty heavy chemotherapy for 21, 28 days. Breaks in there, and that's not all continuous for a month. But three of the six times that I had week-long inpatient chemotherapy, I ended up back in the hospital a week later to recover from the chemotherapy. So kind of a severe pounding on the blood counts and ability to regenerate cells for the functions we need.
So has this illness given you a different outlook on life, would you say?
Yeah, inevitably it has to. When one's time could be short, it makes you reflect upon what you've done, what you really want to do with the time you have left. So I think it has made me a better person, where I learned to forgive Tamara's parents and her over the serious hurt that I thought they were either recklessly or intentionally causing me. We were always civil over the years, but there was never any warmth to it. And so we've been able to recapture that family feeling even with her family. And so I think, yes, it has made me a better person. And, you know, life's a journey, not a destination. So I've just had a slightly different journey, and the path has been directed in a different manner. But, you know, I think I'm learning to take whatever time I have left as a gift. And come what may, it's fast reaching the point where it's probably out of my hands very much. So I'm prepared to accept the consequences.
On a happier note, can you remember, or what would you say would be the happiest moment in your life?
Oh, gosh, this will sound silly, I suppose, but I do remember the tremendous exhilaration in my freshman year at U of A, where I won the mile run among the applicants for the basketball team. And what that meant was, not only did I make the team, but I got to start and practice the first week. I was a walk-on candidate for the basketball team. And those were the rules. I'd been invited to come out because I had written to them, and they, you know, wrote a polite letter, you're welcome to come try out when you get here. So I did, and it was a small cadre of 20 or 25 people who thought they had a chance, and I could play with them a little bit, but they were, you know, bigger, stronger mostly. But for me to, oh, hell, win a mile race, I can do that. So I remember the exhilaration and joy that I damn near lapped a couple of them, and so I made the team, and I was going to be starting in practice.
Who would you say was the most important or had the most influence? One person, if you could name one.
One person, most influence. Oh, gosh, that's tough. That's very tough. I'd almost prefer to select from different aspects of life, but I probably should.
Go ahead. No,
well, I was going to give some credit, maybe a little overly broad, but a fellow that I met in Tucson was Roger Ford, who had an upstart business, Alpha Graphics, and somehow he liked the work that I did in his business, and he befriended me and became a mentor, and always found me work when I needed it, and bunked me up in his bunkhouse my third year of law school, where I didn't have a pot to pee in, and I was trying to get through law school. He let me live in his bunkhouse for work on the weekends. Yeah, you came out.
I remember that.
Yeah, I think Roger Ford is a tremendous influence. And almost went to work for him again when I was switching jobs between Del Webb and going back to Nevada. But Roger would certainly be at the top of my list. Professionally, yeah, you know, I think I was struggling to be an average law student. I found one or two sort of kind-hearted professors that took pity on me as some kind of a modest prospect for success in this profession. So, Professor Jack Rappaport, I guess, would be at the top of that university list. So from there, you know, mostly Nevada connections. I was able to move to a small state and meet a lot of people. Richard Bryan, Attorney General, very distinguished U.S. Senator for a couple of years after he was governor. I'll always be proud of the fact that he was a mentor of mine, you know, probably my first real law school job or attorney job. I was very lucky in Nevada to be able to find a little niche where I could kind of grow in the profession, and each job was helpful to the next.
I know you have a close friend, Dennis. Tell me about how you met Dennis and what's your relationship?
I met in the Attorney General's office. Dennis was also a Deputy Attorney General in these Carson City years of the early 80s. So kept in touch reasonably well over the years, although he ended up with the Harris organization in Memphis, but came back to Nevada, and we ended up working at the same law firm together again. So we've just been able to reestablish the personal and professional friendship there. I'm co-trustee with you on my trust.
So how has your life been different than you imagined it might have turned out?
Probably the, you know, white picket fence and the happily thereafter like Beaver. I think Beaver did great damage to many of us with the expectation that's how all families were. So, all in all, I've managed through in the personal relationship field. Almost got remarried once, but I'm glad I didn't. That was about 2 years ago. That would have been a failure. And so, Beaver's pressure notwithstanding, I've survived and have, by and large, healthy relationships with men and women. I don't think I'll ever get remarried, but I wouldn't mind in my waning years to have a travel companion for trips.
So do you have any regrets?
Not really anymore. No, I don't see the point.
What was the proudest moment in your life?
Proudest moment in my life. Well, it's almost, I don't know why I'm so proud of a case that my partner Jack Godfrey basically won for me. It was my client who had screwed up, but Jack helped me get him off in a gaming law matter. And it was very rare to be able to buck the gaming control board in front of the supposedly more impartial gaming commission. But I knew I couldn't take the case because of my relationship with the client. But I did collaborate with Jack behind the scenes on how it could be presented and won. But he won the case, but I felt so goddamn proud. I was like, aha. Because the Gaming Control Board should have taken our offer of settlement. But they chose to go to a hearing and they got goose-egged. So that one comes to mind, you know. I rate my legal career as C-. It's been average. It's not stellar, but I've made a living for damn near 30 years now. The city attorney gig was a nice thing for me because it allowed me this aura of prestige or status within the little community. It's a nice little community, and council members are of varying degrees of sophistication, and so it's easy for me to dazzle them. Not, and I don't mean it in a demeaning way. I'm very polite and deferential. Talk to them in their terms so they understand, but I think they really appreciate it, and I get a little stroke off of, being able to say I'm city attorney and got 11 lawyers that work for me. So it must mean I did okay, or I've done okay.
So you have quite a number of siblings, earlier in the evening we were talking about family nicknames. Would you care to tell us a story about a nickname some of us have Big attributed
Lloyd.
To you?
Big Lloyd, yeah, I guess I'm burdened with this story and maybe the name forever, but just related to basketball, scrimmage of at another high school, Mechanic Arts High School in downtown St. Paul. And during the course of our ferocious struggle, a young lady from the balcony yelled out, "Come on, Big Lord, you can't let them beat." So I reported that story to siblings A, B, and C, and everyone seems to have enjoyed the story to no end.
And so you'll be forever known as Big Lloyd.
Well, you're going to try to get me to cop to that, huh? Only if there are no other takers. So that's about it. It was, you know, ethnicity and grammar gone bad.
So, would you care to share an impression of any of your siblings? Just a quick,
The thumbnail sketches, it's a wonderful group, but it's a lot easier to interact now as adults than it was growing up. Growing up, a little tough to get enough scraps at the table. And I think just the sheer crush of people made it hard for all of us probably to get the love and attention you wanted or felt you needed. So I think we've all worked through that and genuinely enjoy one another's company. It's a group I'll be proud if you say nice things about me at my funeral.
Do you have any closing feelings or a story you'd care to share with us? Or a story about me you'd like to tell?
Oh, you mean where you loaned me the car keys and...
That's an interesting story, sure.
Yeah, where I guess the bottom line there would be is I prevailed upon you to share with me the car keys for a manual transmission automobile about which I had very little clue how to drive the darn thing. And you begrudgingly said, well, all right, but if anything goes wrong, I want no part of this. My fingerprints aren't on this. So I hope I covered you on that. I know I took heat from Pops.
Because as I recall, the car didn't even make it away from the curb without hitting the neighbor's car in front of it.
Yeah, I did kind of lurch into a little fender bender at Weber's car right in front of us. It was... I had a reasonable opportunity to pull left and avoid it, but I just didn't know how to do it. I lurched forward, and I don't think I caught it square on. I think I was angling out.
Okay, well, I guess we'll wrap it up. Thank you, Sean.
Giving me the opportunity to do this.
All right. Press that again. Yeah.